Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Willow, only on LA Talk Radio.
Amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. Excuse me if you see me looking at my phone. I'm trying to share the video, the live Facebook live feed, and I'll be doing that while we're talking, so I'm not trying to be rude. But anyway, we have a great show tonight. Lori Reamer is here with me.
Hello.
My co-patriot in crime. And an amazing guitar player that I'm very honored to have on the show, Jamie Keim. Jamie, welcome to the show. It's
Woo-hoo!
Really a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks. Good to be here.
We're going to take a look at his latest release that he's done, Allies. And it's some really interesting guitar work on it and great tone and stuff. I'm going to mention up front, jamiekeim.com is his website, and you can check out all the stuff that he's doing. But I'm going to start out first, give us a little bit of background so we get an idea where you're coming from and your influences and stuff like that.
How far back would you like me to go?
Well,
when
to kind of...
Yeah.
You were born. And then.
Small shack by the river. I'm originally from San Diego, California. Born down there, and I've been up here in LA full time for since like '95,
mm-hmm.
and have just been, like many players here in town, have just been shuffling around and trying to going from gig to gig and trying to just make a living. It's kind of, I sort of equate it with you have these. Not a sports guy, but my one sports analogy is if you have, like a basketball team with like LeBron James, you have like, a LeBron James or a Michael Jordan, and then all the rest of the guys. Right. I'm all the rest of the guys.
Well, what was it like in terms in when you were a kid, music scene wise, and what were you listening to?
It's like I think I started playing guitar when I was about 9. I started playing drums first, actually, when I was around 7, and took lessons, and then I got involved with the guitar just because I was, I was into rock. I heard Led Zeppelin and, Hendrix, and I was like, what is that? I want to make those sounds,
Mm-hmm.
And from there, it was just kind of, like the snowball,
Was there a pretty good-sized music scene down in San Diego at the time?
At that age, I don't know. All I knew was what was happening in my bedroom and my yard, at that age. Mm-hmm. But as I got a little older, there was a pretty healthy scene down there from what I recall, especially in terms of like, top 40, cover band, like working. And even before I moved up here, I was working quite a bit down there. And, you could work 5-6 nights a week. And there was actually kind of a healthy little session scene because there was a couple of production companies down there that would do national spots. So I was doing a few of those. I was teaching, and then I was working like, you know, 4 to 5 nights a week in various different, you know, sort of working band situations. You know, one night it might be playing a casual, you know, or bar mitzvah or something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, another night you might be playing in at some, you know, ratty little, you know, hole in the wall downtown, you know, and then another night it might be, a corporate gig with a different band wearing a silly, you know, Dayglow suit, you know. All pride is gone, you know. You just kind of like, I was young too. I was like in my late teens, early 20s when all that was going on. So at that point, you just want to work, you know. You're just trying to be it's like, I'm a working musician. I'm living, playing music, you know. But then after a while, it gets to the point where it's like, there's got to be more to life, you know. And I was I got involved with an original band, you know, and we were writing a lot, and we had some, you know, the old label interest, mm-hmm. you know, like we got label interest, and that was when the move to L.A. kind of happened, right around that time.
So what happened in L.A.? How did you get into the session scene? Because you've
I didn't.
Really?
Yeah, I never did. Yeah, I'm not a session player. I mean, everyone says they're a session player up here, but first of all, there's not really any sessions anymore.
That's true.
And so, you know, unless your name is Mike Landau or Tim Pierce or Lukather and it's, you know, 1987, you're not a session guy. You know, people, unless they're doing their own stuff. You know, I mean, people will send me tracks like I did that last week.
But someone mentioned in your bio that you had done some television stuff.
I've done a little bit of TV stuff. There was a show on NBC that was on for about 3 or 4 seasons recently called The Night Shift.
Mm-hmm.
And a good friend of mine named Fred Corey, who's actually a drummer. He was a drummer in the band Cinderella. He was a principal composer on it, and he brought me in to play a lot of the guitar stuff on that. And then there, another friend of mine was a composer for remember the show Robot Chicken?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, on Adult Swim. I did some guitar stuff on that, a few things, you know, when he would need something that he wasn't able to cover.
In those sessions, those TV sessions that you're talking about, did you go to a studio or did you record at home?
I went to their studios, which are in their house, you know.
Yeah.
These aren't like sessions. I'm not going to Ocean Way. Yeah. You know, and having my cartage guy bring all my stuff and play it on the new Wilson Phillips record, you know, it's like, it's nothing like that, mm-hmm. you know. And like last week, somebody sent me a song they wanted some guitars on. I do that at home, you know. So I do a lot of stuff at home now. You know, earlier this year, I did a French artist, you know, sent me a couple of tracks to play on, and I did them, and then they had sent a couple of more. I wound up playing on like 8 or 9 songs on the record.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do that all at home. You know.
Now, let me ask you this. Recording at home, mm-hmm. do you use amps and mic it, or do you use plugins?
I do. It's kind of a combination of both, but there's an amplifier company that's based here out of L.A. called Friedman mm-hmm. Amplification. They have this amp, and I got to tell you, it's an amp called the Runt 20, and it's this little... It's like you could probably fit in the overhead of but it's a little 20-watt amp, and it has a speaker-emulated DI on it that is, are we working blue? Can we?
Well, we do have kids listening.
Okay. It's really good.
It's bleep, bleep, bleep,
yeah.
bleep.
And it sounds so incredible. And, you know, on some of these TV things, you'll go into like their studio at their little project studio that they have, and they'll have like a Kemper or a Fractal. And for those kinds of things, it doesn't really matter. You just use it. But
yeah.
I took home the Runt 20 just to check it out. And I was like, oh, my God. It sounds so good. Within like 20 seconds, I'm tracking. And
yeah.
Yeah. And everything. I just use everything for that.
No, a few months ago, I had Boutique Amps in, and they
sure.
distribute
yep.
the Friedman.
Yep.
And they have this thing called the Synergy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's... hot swappable preamps, yeah. and I have the Dirty Shirley and the yeah. HB. They're great.
All their modules are so good. I would really like to get a Synergy unit. Even the they have the one that's just a single, and then they have the one that has the two.
Two, you can put the two in.
Yeah, I just like to have a single and just get a couple of modules.
But they have that in the Morgan AC30, so you can get all the amp flavors
really
that
good,
you want
yeah.
out of one
So, yeah,
there's a really good. The Friedmans are killer.
The Dirty Shirley one is really nice. The Bassman one is really good. I've heard the Morgan ones as well. They're really great.
And they're coming out with the Dumbo one.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay.
That should be fun.
That, there should be a lot of controversy around that.
Yes, of course. Yeah. But let me, I'm going to play a clip I cut together. Now, let me explain to you these clips on this album. The name of the album is Allie's, and this is the title cut. This is an edit, so I kind of skipped a couple of verses. It's all guitars.
Yeah, it's a mashup. You did a mashup.
A mashup. So, yeah. But anyway, just listen to, in this one especially, how he layers the guitar parts and then, of course, the lead. And then we'll talk a little more about, you know, well, hopefully you'll remember what you used on this one.
Hopefully, yeah.
The big question. Here we go. This is Allie's. That was very cool.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Now, I want to ask you a little bit. It's interesting how you, the way the rhythm guitars, or I don't know if they're, I would technically, because you're playing kind of a riff, and it counterpoints with the bass.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did you write out the bass part, or was that?
I didn't. I mean, that song just kind of started life as that sort of, you know, sort of. And then it had sort of that sort of like little funky double stop thing on top of it. Originally, that was something that I played into a looper, and it was like a really early version of the, remember the Line 6, the big green delay with the four knobs on it that had the looping function. I was a beta tester for that, like way back before that came out. And that was just something as I was messing with it that I played into it. And I liked it, so I took the output of the pedal and plugged it into my computer at the time and just kind of saved it. And that's where it lived on my computer for many, many years before it finally turned into that song. So, yeah, I didn't write out the bass part. It was when we originally tracked it, Mike Keneally, who co-produced the album with me, played bass on it. And then the bass tracks were eventually replaced by a guy named Pete Griffin, who was my bandmate in Zappa Play Zappa, and who's currently on tour with Steve Vai, actually. So, yeah, I never really write out bass part because, you know, it's like I play with such great players. It's like, here, this is what I'm doing. Come up with something cool.
Because that's really precise stuff. There's not, I mean, to get those harmonies and what you're doing rhythmically and the syncopation besides harmonically.
Right.
It's a credit to the players because, I mean, that's that's pretty precise. I mean, I don't see there's a lot of wiggle room in there.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it, too, is just it was just supposed to kind of really be this fat sort of, you know, F-sharp groove, you know, which is, you know, but it, and then once we kind of got in there and started layering on all these different parts, it sort of started taking on a little bit of the shape that I think you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Now, the rhythm guitarist, what were you, do you remember what you were using?
Oh, man, I think I was playing, on the basic track, I think I was playing a 64 Strat, which is another guitar that I own, and then I probably doubled it. I have a Les Paul that I play all the time, mm-hmm. and probably that. I think the little slide parts, the little bad finger kind of, you know, slide parts, and then the solo was done with a 335. Not this 335 that I have, but the guy whose studio I did all the overdubs at is a guy named Rick Musalam, who's a great mm-hmm. guitar player and engineer, and he had a really nice 335. I wound up using that on a lot of the album.
Right. Now, the rhythm guitars, were you using amps or was that similar?
No, that was all amps. It was all, everything was mic'd. I think we had, I think it was a Jim Kelly head into like a old Marshall 412, and then there's also an amp I have called a Snider, Snider, mm-hmm. and I think I use that for some stuff. The kind of slide parts and all the fills and all the single note stuff, the solos was a Marshall. It was like a modified, you know.
And what about the lead?
That was a Marshall.
A Marshall.
Yeah, that was a Marshall, I think.
Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you about the lead.
Or you know what? Let me. Now that I think about it, I think it actually might have been a Super. Like a Fender Super Reverb with like a pedal. It might have been, yeah. I think that's what it was now that I recall.
That's a great, yeah.
Yeah.
Super Reverbs are great amps.
Yeah. Just kind of turned up and I had a pedal. It was probably like a way huge, you know, like a Green Rhino or Red Llama or something
mm-hmm,
like that. Because
mm-hmm.
I use those a lot. So.
Now, what I'm noticing in your tone of your lead, it's very interesting. And I asked you a little bit before the show, but I want to get in a little more detail. You alternate from using a pick to fingers, right?
Yeah, a lot. Because
it changes the sound.
Yeah.
Like some of the leads where you get in there. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I can, I think.
But he has to play while he's talking.
Yeah, it's because at this point, it's nothing that I don't really think about it that much as I'm playing. So, you know, I'll switch back and forth from, you know, doing the pick and then the hybrid thing where it's like the pick and the fingers, especially for...
Because when you're playing that blown out sound, there's a sound that you get and it doesn't sound like a pick. It sounds like you're fucking.
Yeah, so, you know...
Okay, so he's using his thumb there.
So that's like the thumb and the fingers. That's more the sort of the traditional kind of like, you know, I guess chicken picking kind of, you know. You know, so you can get that fleshy part of the thumb.
Right, like when you play with the gain up and you're really going at it, it's an interesting tonality.
It's different. Yeah, and you can really, and you get a different... And you can control the dynamics a lot differently with, you know, with your fingers. Because at this point, I kind of have some calluses on the finger of my right hand as mm-hmm. well. So, you know, you can really kind of get a different sort of control over the dynamics with the fingers that you can with a pick. That, you know, you even when you pick lighter...
That you're already using your fingers.
Yeah, it's hard for me not to. But even when you pick lighter with the pick, you still have that same attack, whereas with the fingers you can get a little more, you know, nail if you want to, or the, you know, skin, you know, get some skin.
Yeah, but it's interesting because you'll hear it in the phrasing and that tonality change. It's subtle, but it adds to the to the tone. It's an interesting sound.
Yeah, I've had people ask me about it, and students will like, and because my pick will just kind of like disappear into my hand and I can kind of on the fly, you know, go to fingers and then bring, and then.
But it's interesting because it's pretty transparent. You just, it's automatic. You know,
Yeah, I don't even, it's very unconscious at this point. You know, I don't really think about it. Sometimes I'll do like an entire gig with like little or no pick at all. Mm-hmm. You know, won't even take it out of my pocket. You know, it comes in real handy when you need to do, you know, any kind of, you know, sort of funky or sort of scratchy parts.
Well, speaking of funky, scratchy parts, I'm going to play this clip from Bottle Rocket.
Okay.
So you do this kind of Hendrix thing on the rhythm guitar, and then you do these cool guitar riffs under, and then you have the dueling leads.
Yeah.
And we were talking a little bit before the show about that originally that was going to be a guest shot. You were going to play against somebody. What happened?
Well, I think at the time it just sort of worked. It turned out to be sort of a scheduling thing. When we were... This album took a while to do, you know, and at the time I was touring a lot, and Mike Keneally, who was producing it with me, he was touring a lot. So we would sort of meet up, you know, we would look at the schedule and like, okay, I'll be home 2 months from Tuesday for 3 days, and okay, I'll be home those days, and then we would sort of rush in and work on the record a little bit. So I had... On Bottle Rocket, I had one of the solos, I think it was the first one, because it goes back and forth from B7 to B-flat 7. I think it was the B7 parts. I had those and then the holes there, and with the intention of having my friend John Ziegler, who was sort of a musical partner of mine for many years. We were doing the weekly Monday Night Jam at the Baked Potato for like, you know, 13, 14 years. And it just getting him over to the studio was like, and it just never, you know, because if we would get there, it's like, oh yeah, I wanted to get John here. I didn't tell him about it. Let me see if I can get him here. And then I won't be able to get a hold of him. Mm-hmm. You know, so finally we just needed to finish up. And then I did the other part. So it became a guitar duel with myself.
Now, before playing it, did you use different guitars or and different amps to?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Do you remember what you used?
It was probably, I think on one of them, I don't specifically, but I know that we were using that. Rick Musallam had a great Marshall, and I was using that a lot for a lot of the solos. The Snyder California I was using a lot. And I don't think I used the Fender for any of the leads on that song at all.
So they're the Gibsons?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll play the clip. But it's interesting to hear the two guitars play against each other.
I think one of them was a Strat, and one was a Les Paul, and one was a Strat.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because it's but anyway, let's play it, and then you can tell me a little more. But I love the rhythm guitar on this one. This one's a really cool one. So here's a clip of Bottle Rocket. That sound, I'd be shocked if those leads were not the Marshall. It sounded like Marshall.
Yeah, I think it was all
that
Marshall.
That thing just sounds great.
That was the one for the headphones, for sure.
Yes.
Yeah, some good use of the panning. And that sort of phase shifty effect on the second guitar, the sort of answer guitar. That was done post. The mix engineer named Dave Jenkins, he was, in order to sort of set the two, to really sort of, you know, like, you know, set those two guitar solos apart, you know. It's like, let's,
but there's a lot of bite to the to both of the guitar parts, and then those were, and so those were Gibsons, right?
I think one of them was a Strat that it was a Strat with the hot rails in it, so it's a super hot, you know, so it sounds really Gibson-y. And then the other one was my Les Paul.
Now, did you use a pedal to overdrive the Marsh, or was that just dimed out?
I might have had a boost in front of it.
What do you normally use to boost your?
Sometimes I use this. I have a little pedal here called a CUDA, but at the time I was probably maybe a Tube Screamer or you know, or a Green Rhino, you know, way huge Green Rhino.
Well, since you brought it up, we should talk a little bit about this pedal board.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you I'll let you play through it.
Okay.
And show the pedals, and then I'm going to have them lifted up for the Facebook Live people so they can see it. It's kind of, there's some stuff that's not permanently on there, so we have to be careful.
Yeah.
But go ahead and explain what you got here, because it's an interesting pedal board.
Well, I used to have a much larger board for touring, and then for fly dates, I needed something that was small that would fit into a little, like a laptop bag that I could just carry on.
We've heard that theme before.
Yeah, so that's how this kind of started life, and then it just sort of came to be my main board, because, you know, I don't really use a ton of stuff, and so everything I can kind of fit onto here. So we'll kind of start. What should I do? Should I go through the pedals first, and then we'll do show and tell? And
Go ahead and start by the signal chain from the guitar.
So the guitar goes, the first thing it hits is this this pedal that's in the first position right now is an Octavio. It's a Dunlop MXR pedal. It's just kind of one of their limited edition. It's like an Octavia, so it's that sort of Hendrix, you know.
So it's a distortion with an octave.
With a high, it's like a fuzz with a high octave. You know, so. And the higher up the neck you play on the neck pickup, it really.
Yeah, you get that pinch sound.
Yeah, so that's kind of a fun little pedal. Sometimes I have just a straight fuzz in that position, and I'll swap them in and out. But and then the second one here is, I think this is the second one. Yeah, this is the second one is called a CUDA. It's made by a company called SIB, which is they make great pedals. They make like the old Very Dry pedal. I don't know if you remember those, but the big pedal with the tube in it.
Mm-hmm.
This is also a tube pedal. This is kind of, he has two versions of this. One's just a regular CUDA, and this one's an LT, which is sort of the lower gain version. But I use it for, you know, kind of a light gain sort of. So here it is without it. Straight into this, massive sounding solid state Marshall amp.
Yeah.
So I don't have it set for a ton of gain right now. I just kind of, you know, it's slightly more than unity in terms of the output, and just a little bit of it kind of gives some nice attack on the notes and a little bit of drive. This other one here is I don't even know that I'm supposed to be discussing it, because he has a piece of tape over it. It's kind of a secret pedal that's not out yet. But it does this. It's a drive.
That's nice.
It sounds really good, and I like it because the amp that I normally use is a Friedman Dirty Shirley. That's on my regular Baked Potato gig. That's what I use. And that amp is pretty much just dimed. You know, it's just turned up all the way.
Mm-hmm.
And so the amp itself is kind of is grinding a little bit. And this pedal sounds really great as a boost into an amp that's already kind of driven. But into a clean amp, it works real nice as well. And it responds really nicely to the volume knob, you know, so. You know, so
it's nice. I mean, it's real. Yeah, you can hear it.
You know, and then back it down, and it cleans up really nice. So I've really been loving it. I just put it on there a couple of weeks ago. And next, I think I hit this tremolo pedal, which I've had for a really long time. It's by Tone Freak, a company called Tone Freak Effects, and it's just their mellow trim, and it's just a tremolo. What I really love about it is it has a volume control on it. So a lot of times with traditional tremolo pedals, you have the rate and the depth. And as you crank the depth up, the output kind of drops on the pedal, so you can get some, you know, you get some makeup gain. So even when you crank the depth, you know, you don't lose output. It also, right. Interestingly, when you turn the rate and the depth all the way down and crank up the volume knob, it works really nice as a boost as well.
Oh, really?
Which was sort of an accidental discovery.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, hey, this is great. So, and then I have the Blue Hippo, which is the Way Huge Blue Hippo, which is a chorus. I've never been a big chorus user, but this pedal is great because it has that little switch in the middle that kills all of the dry signal. So all you're just left with the modulated signal, and it kind of...
Kind
of has
cool.
This really kind of seasick sort of, you know.
So that's just the warbling of the,
yeah,
that would normally flange it.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, when you switch this down, then you're back to, you know, traditional kind of chorus. But I've never been the biggest fan of chorus pedal, so I kind of like that.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I was a big for many years. I used an actual Leslie, and I really love that sound. You know, so if it's, you know, I like that sound. That to me, that's a different kind of the Doppler effect. I'll still break it out every now and again, but and then right here, just a delay. It's the the Dunlop
Echoplex
pedal. I actually use a real Echoplex at my Monday night gig that I do. I actually
really?
Have an old EP3 that, you know, it has to be serviced every so often. But but yeah, I have a really nice sounding one, and I use that. But on gigs where I'm not taking that out, I like the Echoplex pedal, which they really nailed the characteristic kind of wow and flutter that are an actual real one.
No, I have an original Echoplex.
Yeah.
Is your solid state or tube?
So EP3 is solid state.
Okay.
So yeah, I'm a big fan of the EP3s in particular.
Because Dunlop makes another Echoplex pedal. It's just the preamp.
The preamp,
overdrive.
Yeah. Yeah, those are great too. Those work nice as a boost, but yeah. So
that's
there you go.
Very cool.
And then I have this little, the other one here is not, I don't use this one all the time. That's why it's kind of off to the side, but it's a little reverb pedal. I figured it's just, I like reverb, sue me, you know. It just makes it.
But would you use the pedal over the amp? Like if you had a super reverb,
I would use a reverb in the amp.
In the amp.
Yeah.
Okay.
The reason I got that is I had to lug on, you know, smaller gigs and gigs where I'm not using the, you know, oh my God, hey. And the reverb in that amp was so unreliable that I just took the reverb tank out and I just got that pedal. So that's the primary reason I even have that.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Well, the Friedman doesn't have reverb, right?
Right.
So you're using it on there.
Yeah. So I'll use that. I use with the Friedman, I'll run it into have you heard of the Fryette power station? Are you hip to that?
Mm-hmm.
That box? I use one of those, man. That thing has been a life changer because all of a sudden I can take out like these old Marshalls and just use them in a small club, and you can turn them up all the way, and they, you know, and you can, they're transparent. It just sounds like the amp, just quieter. But those things also have a great loop in them as well, so it's like a post loop. So I'll put the Echoplex and this reverb pedal in the loop of the power station, and it's, you know, and it's perfect because it's post, you know, they're post effects.
So you don't lose any.
Yeah.
That's a problem with a lot of loops.
Yeah.
Is the gain. You lose the gain.
Yeah. Or if you, you know, a gainy amp, if you run a delay, like an Echoplex in front of it, then you get your clean signal is what's delayed, and it sounds really funny. So this is like, this is like post delay and post verb, where it's where it should be.
Where it should be. Actually, it's interesting. The Synergy. I think that main frame is a Fryette design.
Yeah, it is.
It's it is. So yeah. That same type of circuit. Yeah. But it, yeah, that's always been a problem. I've usually with a pedal board go into the amp to try to keep the gain up.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's interesting. That's really interesting. That
it's. It's funny that, like, after playing guitar and having these amps and these things around for so many years, that finally, just within, the, like, the last, you know, few years, these issues are getting addressed, you know, just in time for the modeling thing to take over.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting debate between the two. I mean, live, I get it. You know, it's, and especially now with flying everywhere.
Yeah.
If you can just put it in your laptop or your iPhone. I know one guy uses the iRig, and he's happy with it.
Yeah.
But there's something about moving air.
It's, there's, I'm kind of, I mean, I guess I'm just.
An amp is an amp.
Anyway. Yeah.
It's just, you know, you're pushing tubes. It's, there's a certain sound to that.
But you're right. I mean, it depends on the gig. I met a guy a couple of weeks ago who's in the touring company of, I forget the name of the show. I feel like such a bonehead forgetting it. But it's a Broadway, touring company of a Broadway production, and they're out here in LA, and I was asking him what he's using. He's like, Kemper's. You know, it's all virtual.
Yeah.
You know, they just want it to be, you know, and I think that was a stipulation when he got the gig. They're like, no amps, nothing live, you know, nothing, or nothing live, nothing, you know, no amps on stage.
No physical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No moving air. Yeah. You know?
It makes it easier too. One of my upcoming guests is a guy that basically sets up backline in the Midwest for most for concerts, and with something like a Kemper, you just, you know, 4x12 Celestian cabinets are pretty easy to get, and it makes it a lot easier than trying to get a good head that's, you know, that's going to get you the tone that you want.
They're consistent, and you know, and if that's what the gig is, that's, you know, that's what it is,
right?
You know, but also there's other solutions now with, like, the, you know, Universal Audio with the aux.
Yeah,
the aux box,
that's very
which is,
cool.
You know, my good friend of mine, James Santiago, is one of the sort of principal guys over there that worked on that. And I heard a real early version of it, and I was like, this is gonna kill everything, because you can still use your stuff.
Yeah.
Of course, the issue is if you're doing a touring thing where they don't want you to take anything, then you're back to
it's a good
one,
size.
You know?
It's a good size. Linda Taylor, great guitar player. She has one. She brought it in.
Yeah.
And the cool thing about it is you can do multiple mic emulation. Yeah. So you can do the Jimmy Page secret sound of the three mics where you have the one mic way back.
Yeah.
And you can choose the mics and the cabinet and the speakers. It's all choosable.
And the Verb, you know, the Verb. And they sound great, and they feel great because you're still plugging into your amp.
Yeah, and she was using her guitar head and cranked it.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Pretty cool.
So, but you've toured a bit too, right?
Yeah, I have. Not in the last couple of years, but I have,
Do you want to talk about your, a little bit about that?
Sure. I was, my primary touring gigs, like back in 2005 and 2006, I was in the original lineup of Zappa Play Zappa with Dweezil and the first lineup of that band, and I did that until like the middle of 2012, and that was a pretty exciting thing because, you know, when he was just getting it off the ground, we didn't know what the reception was going to be, and it was originally intended to just go for like a year. We were just going to do like tour all, for a year solid, and then that would be it. And he's still doing it. You know, I mean, they're out on the road right now with it.
When you were playing with him, and I know he's a big fractal.
He is now, yeah.
What were you using?
I was using Bogner. I had a Bogner Shiva. And at one time I had two, and I was using a pair of those combos.
Was he using amps back then, or was he using?
The first couple of years he did use amps. He was using a lot of Fuchs amps. He had a crazy rig that consisted of some, like I think a Fuchs and
I know he had Bogner. I've seen an interview with him, and he had the Bogner pedals.
Yeah, he had a whole he had
it's a huge
like
pedal
30 board. Or more pedals, you know, with all kinds of crazy. So he had like some old vintage pedals, and then some newer stuff as well. He had like an old Tycho Brahe Octavia. He had some. He had I think he had an original Maestro Fuzz on there. Trying to remember, he had kind of a mix of old and new stuff. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was a pretty elaborate, crazy rig where it was actually split into, you know, people talk about, oh, I'm in stereo, which means they're just running through a pedal board like this and then splitting out to two amps. But he actually had two discrete stereo paths of stuff, and then he had and then his effects were separate. So it was like, you know, effects path A over here on the left, you know, and effects path B on the right, and then center wet caps, you know, so the all the time based stuff and reverb was completely separate from the dry stuff.
But he was using a fully blown pedal board, and then he also had rack stuff.
He was using
a pretty complex.
Yeah,
setup.
There was like an Eventide in there, and a few other things. It's been so long, I can't remember.
But. And you also played with him when he did the orchestra stuff, right?
I don't think so. Did he do some of that? I'm not sure.
There was something that mentioned you were doing Zappa with
orchestra. Oh, that was the 200 Motels thing. That was separate from Zappa Play Zappa.
Okay.
That was the LA Philharmonic did the world premiere of the orchestral suites of 200 Motels, which was, you know, there was of course that movie, you know, the Frank Zappa movie, but. There was all the music there that was in there. He wrote a suite of like orchestra pieces, and it had never really been played in its entirety. And back in I think it was late 2013, the LA Philharmonic did it, and Esa Pekka Salonen, the great conductor,
that must have been
he
fun.
Was conducting it. And so it was a full blown orchestra with the master
wow.
chorale. And a rock band, and I was in the rock band. It was me and Scott Tunez on bass, and Ian Underwood and Joe Travers.
Yeah, Ian Underwood played a lot of Zappa stuff.
And we were just, you know, so there's from me to you, there's Esa Pekka, and I'm sitting
so
right
what
there.
Did you use on that? Because that's, I presume you had to use small stuff.
I used a deluxe. I used an old deluxe. Yeah, it actually belonged to my friend Rob Timmons, who runs the pickup company, Arcane mm-hmm. Pickups. And he has a really nice old deluxe, and I use that. And yeah, the orchestra hated it. They hated us. They hated us. They couldn't wait for that show to be done and for us to be the hell out of there. You know, they were just, you know, we were right in front of like right, and we were right in front of the
rockers had the limelight.
The flautists. Well, we were loud, you know, the drums, and they were just like,
yeah, they don't like it.
They were like, can you turn the drums down? And we're like, well, it doesn't really work that
That's
way.
That's so
funny. You know? But like yeah, they were not crazy about us, but it was a pretty you know, staggering moment in the career to just be in Disney Hall on that stage playing with, you know, that conductor, and it sounded so huge in the room, and you know, and it was this big sold out event, and it was a lot of fun. It was, you know,
I can
probably
only imagine.
Probably the most stressful week of my life.
Nah.
Once it was over, I was like, that was great. Let's do it again.
It's like having a baby.
Yeah. I want to do this all the time. And then like a year, I think of the following year, I went to Prague and I did something like a similar thing with the Prague National Symphony. And Scott Tunez and Joe Travers went on. And again, the same thing, just stressful, just, you know.
They didn't like you guys.
They were a little more, they liked us a little bit more. They didn't mind us so much. But just the process of, you know, it was a whole new program of material. And a lot of it was just so hard, you know.
Yeah,
and, you know, stuff I had never played before. There's pieces that we never did in Dweezil's band. And so, again, it was just like a whole week of not sleeping. And then, you know, once it was over, it's like, oh, yeah, when's the next one?
Yeah, people don't realize that Zappa wrote all this. I remember a studio tale of Zappa that they were doing. Somebody was doing a session, and it was there was a vibe part.
Yeah.
So there was all, and it was just notes.
Yeah.
You know, just a sea of notes.
Yeah.
And I forgot who the session person was playing, but they were working through it, and he walked by and he said, "No, no, no, it's like this."
Yeah.
And he played it.
Yeah. It was.
And the person who told me like, about this, they were floored. Like, you know, because you see this guy with his beard, long hair,
You
know, total hippie type of thing in that era, that time. And he's just like, no, like this.
Yeah. We were talking about Don Randy earlier, who's the great Don Randy, who's, and he played on a Zappa album. He played on some sessions. Mm-hmm. And he, the way he tells it, he wound up on the record in a similar way, because they had all these other players that they didn't know how to read, you know, the parts, because there's all these like compound meters and, you know, shifting time signatures, and they didn't know how to approach it. And Don came in and was able to nail it and was able to play it. And he said that the way he did it was he just almost ignored I don't mean to like quote him directly, but what I was getting out of the way he explained it was he kind of ignored the time signature and just played it as one long melody.
Right, yeah.
And I was like, you know what? That's kind of what I did too when we were first learning songs like Inca Roads and those long parts in the middle that have all those shifting.
Yeah.
You know, and you try to count that stuff out while you're learning it just doesn't work. You have to learn it almost as just a long phrase. And then if you listen to the vocal melody as well, it's like, oh, okay, I get it. He's writing around these words.
Yeah.
Mm. You know.
But it's interesting because those keyboard players that played in the Mothers of Invention,
yeah,
they weren't shabby players. They were amazing musicians in that band.
And they became even more amazing musicians just in the course of their service in that band.
So. Now, we're almost out of time, but
okay,
you got to tell me about this guitar. Because it's a .NET 335, but it says Orville by Gibson. So tell me a little bit about this.
I bought this guitar off of Dave Friedman from Friedman Amplification a couple years ago. It's you're familiar with like Fender Japan and how they did like the Squire. Gibson was doing a similar thing for a time back in the 90s. Their Japan line was called Orville, and it was made in the same factory as, you know, Fender Japan and Squire. It was made in the Fujigen factory, or Fujigen, however you want to say it, in Japan. And they had two versions. They have ones that on the headstock said Orville, and then ones that said Orville by Gibson. And this is just based on my research that I've done. So if there's any, like, Orville by Gibson experts out there, don't get mad at me if I get something wrong. But the ones that said Orville were made in the factories over there, and they used all Japanese components, pickup electronics and hardware. Orville by Gibson, they were manufactured in the factory over there, but they use USA components, USA pickups, hardware. They're both amazing guitars, and this one I believe the serial number dates to around 93, late 93, and you know, they were some might argue that they were better than the Gibson USAs of the day. I don't know. I've never done a side-by-side comparison. Dave had the guitar. It would have been hanging on his wall for a couple of years. And then one day he was like, I'm going to sell that. I was like,
sounds nice.
Sell it to me.
Sounds like it plays good.
Yeah. The only thing was the back pickup was intermittent when I got it from Dave. And I thought, you know, I thought it was a switch. And then it turns out that the pickup just was, you know, it had a short in it somewhere in the windings. So I had an old T-top, and I took it to Rob Timmons at Arcane, and he put a nice nickel cover on it, stuck it in there, and it's, you know.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
That's a nice guitar.
Yeah.
Well, I told you it would go by fast.
And it did.
The website is jamiekine.com. Basically, give us a little bit of what's going on, where you're playing, or...
I do a monthly residency at the Baked Potato with a band that just by default is called the Jamie Kime Group, because Justin Randy said, I need a name for this. And I was like, I just called the Jamie Kime Group. But it's it is me, my good friend Toshi Yanagi, who you also
been on
know.
The show, yeah.
And Toshi plays guitar in the band as well. Matt Rohde plays keys.
Amazing.
Phenomenal keyboard player. Danny Carey is our drummer from the band Tool. Chris Roy is our bass player. And we play the first Monday of every month, and we have a really good time, and it's...
Special guests come, sit in,
sometimes,
sing.
Yeah. Ben Thomas, who is also in Zappa, plays Zappa with me, the singer. He's been coming down and singing a lot, and it's sort of evolving into that sort of a thing, because people really seem to like the vocal tunes.
They like his Huey Lewis.
Yeah, right. But we always wind up having a great time, and it's always pretty well attended. And you know, I used to do a weekly thing there, John Ziegler and I, and Chris Roy, and then John about a year and a half ago. Unfortunately, he had a pretty devastating stroke, so he's been out of action. We continued the weekly Monday nights for a while, and then Justin at one point said, would you rather just do a once-a-month thing with your own? It won't be a jam. And I was like, yeah, it might be time to do that. Turned out to be a great thing. And it's also nice because I love having the same group of players every month.
Right, right.
Unless somebody's out. So.
Yeah, but then we can find a sub. But, mm-hmm. You know, like Chris is out. Chris Roy's out this next one, and so we have to find a sub to play bass. So, mm-hmm. You know, we'll see if Jimmy Earl wants to do it or, you know, someone
else.
Well,
the album that we were playing clips from, it, and I'm going to play one more to take us out, is Allie's.
Allie's,
it's available everywhere, right?
Yeah, CD Baby, iTunes, I think, like the Amazon music thing. You can get it up there as well. But, yeah, it's been out since late 2014. It's time for me to do another one.
There you go.
But nudge, nudge.
Live at the Baked Potato.
I know, right?
Yeah. It's easy. Hey.
That hasn't been done before.
Yeah, right?
And then, Lori, what's going on?
Well, besides this once a month that I help Jamie with, we have tomorrow night the wonderful Judith Owen, British singer-songwriter, keyboard player, together with legendary bass player Leland Sklar, who actually produces her. And that's going to be at Bogey's tomorrow evening. And then just making my pitch for the annual Tribe show that's coming up. It's a benefit concert for homelessness at the El Rey, and that's on December 1st. And Jeff will post those, I'll post them on Music Magic. And there we go.
So I'm going to take us out with a clip of Woodley Park. And the reason I picked that is there's some interesting stuff.
Yeah.
I love the bass part. The bass is very cool on it. But you do like this ambient type of volume pedal type guitar thing.
Yeah.
Now, are you doing that with your finger on the knob or are you using a pedal?
I think that was done on a Telecaster. So I believe it's I'm doing it manually with the...
Okay, that was a Telecaster?
Pinky on the volume.
It's a great sound. And then also, as we're taking us out, listen to the rhythm guitars. There's some really cool things going on in there.
That was done kind of live impromptu in the studio. That's Mike Keneally playing bass on that one, too.
Oh, so, really?
Yeah, for those Keneally fans. That's him.
He's good.
Yeah. That was kind of fun.
I'm writing this down so I remember.
The basic track was done live, and then I overdubbed all the other stuff.
So anyway, listen, thank you so much. We'll have to have you back on.
Anytime,
I told you.
Thank you.
I can never fit it all in one show.
Well,
I told him that too.
I live real close to here. I'm just a couple blocks away, so anytime.
That's cool. We'll definitely, and nudge, nudge on the new album. I can't wait to hear more stuff from you.
Thanks, man.
Lori, thank you again for putting this together.
This was a good one.
And just being here. Mm-hmm. It's great to have both of you guys here. This is Woodley Park. Everybody have a great week. We will see you next week. And have a great Thanksgiving.
So,
all right. Take care.